Coleman National Monument in Chicago, Illinois, with your host, Dr. Lynn Hughes.
Welcome to Live at the Pullman National Monument. This is our second show, and we have a great show for you today. Our guest, our first guest is David Parada, author of Those Pullman Blues, but he's in our second segment. But I want to start first by talking about what's happening at the Pullman National Monument. There's a lot going on there, and I'll just jump right in. For those of you who are aware, and perhaps those of you who heard our first show, we talked about the National Park Service coming into the area where we are located in the Pullman District and the home of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. And we're delighted about that. That was the area that President Barack Obama designated as a Pullman National Monument in February of 2015. Now, the National Park Service coming in represents a tremendous opportunity, a life-changing opportunity, actually, for the community, but only if things are handled properly, and only if politics doesn't get in the way, and only if the people of the area feel like they are a part of and are welcome to participate in the planning of the area. So that is kind of what my first segment is going to be about. There, things are moving so fast. Developers and the like have all recognized the opportunity that having a neighbor as large as the National Park Service in the area, and it presents wonderful opportunities. It represents a multiple array of opportunities. It represents opportunities for those who are wealthy and have big bank accounts and finances who can then develop and foster projects, that multi-million dollar projects. But it also represents opportunities for the little guy in the area who wants to create a small business for himself. It can be something as insignificant to you as a novelty shop, but it represents a lot to that person who is in that area, who has perhaps been in that area for 20, 30 years, perhaps. And I just hope it is our intention to sort of use this platform to keep people on task, to make sure that they realize and recognize that they have to open the door and let the little person in so that they too can benefit from the cultural economic development that the National Park Service existence or coming into the area represents. I also want to talk about the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. That is located in the Pullman National Monument. The museum is there, founded in 1995, and has been in that area for 21 years, has developed a niche of Black labor history and civil rights history in that area. Before the museum opened there, there was nothing that represented the African-American population or image or culture, if you will. And so I also plan to use this platform to, again, keep those folks honest, shall we say, and make them keep them mindful that we are there. We have been there for 20 years, and so we have no intention of allowing, shall we say, a collaborative effort to come in and take place or take away the niche that we have spent 20 years creating. And while that may not be the intentionality of the broader group, we all know how politics works, and that could very well happen. But I'm grateful for this opportunity to have this wonderful platform that will allow me to every now and then make a comment like I'm doing today. That may, in fact, make some folks a little bit uncomfortable. But that's a good thing, because when the public knows about something, they can participate in something. Which comes to mind, brings to mind, there's something that the National Park Service has called a public comment period. And they're creating something called a foundational document. I spoke about this on our first show. Foundational document is more or less a management plan or operations manual for a National Park Service site. And there has to be what is called a public comment period. Excuse me. And those of you who are the public can go to the National Park Service website, find the Pullman National Monument on that site, and click on the foundational document and put in your public comment. You can read the document for yourself. You don't have to go or take what I'm saying as gospel, but you can certainly go in and read the document and make the comments that you deem appropriate for the areas that you see that need commenting on. So I think that I'm being told that I need to move on. Oh, I have a little more time.
I got a little more time.
Well, let me talk a little bit more about the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. We're what is called a boutique museum. And by that, I mean it is a small museum, but it is a serious theme museum. And so the Pullman National Monument operates, it is a different from other national monuments in that it is not just a building. It is what is called a thematic district. And so in the Pullman National Monument, it's supposed to operate on themes. There is architecture, because Pullman is known for this gorgeous Queen Anne architecture. It is also known for labor history. It is also known for Black labor history, which is our niche. It is a niche that I personally created and began to create in 1995 when no one was ever even talking about it. But what seems to have happened, I must have done a really good job, because now everybody and their mother is suddenly an expert on A. Philip Randolph and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And they are filled with sound bites and all kind of fancy and slick marketing pieces. But the development of the A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, it is authentic. It is from the heart. And it is all that we do and all that we have done for 21 years. And so that is who we are, what we do, and that is what is happening at the Pullman National Monument. And check out our website. It's the PullmanPorterMuseum.com, and you can find out all the interesting things that we are doing there and the things that we'd like to do. And hopefully, we'll be able to have a bit more conversation about the Pullman National Monument as we go along. And there's all kinds of interesting things happening, including the creation of this show, live at the Pullman National Monument. We are thrilled to be able to have a platform that talks about what's happening at the Pullman National Monument, and we will continue to do that. Thanks to BBS Radio. And I want to take a moment and say that I'm looking forward to our guest, David Parada, who's the author of a book called Those Pullman Blues. And he is just, the book is filled with a wealth of information about this particular subject matter. It's the African-American railroad attendant, and very interesting story. So I won't elaborate, because I don't want to take away from what he's going to talk about. And our third guest, our segment number three, is something we're calling Around the Museum Table. And this particular segment, starting with today, we will have a guest from museums around the country who will come and talk about the things that they're doing or what's happening at their particular museum. And we are just very pleased and honored to have as our guest today the premier of that particular segment around the museum table, Mr. David A. Peterson, who is president and executive director for the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. We had a little bit of a glitch there, but we are anxious to talk with Mr. Peterson and anxious to hear some of the things that he's talking about today. And we are still looking so forward to talking with him. Lastly, I wanted to say a huge thanks to that serious music that you heard earlier, courtesy of Jonathan Fritzen. He is an artist from Sweden who allowed us to use his music throughout the show. And we are grateful to him for that and to Andy Howard Management, who facilitated that permission happening. And so we just want to give a big shout out to them. And we look forward to continuing that interesting creative collaboration. And we've got lots to talk about today. So we'll be back in a moment. Well, we are back. We're back. And welcome back to Live at the Pullman National Monument. I'm so excited about this show today. I have as my very special guest, David Parada, who is author of Those Pullman Blues. He's one of my favorite people in the whole world. And I'm very pleased that he's with us today, because he's going to be talking about a subject that is, of course, near and dear to my heart. And that is the African-American Railroad attendant and the tremendous legacy and lessons that they have left for us, and not just for African-American people, but for all people. And so, David Parada, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So one of the things that I want to do is I'm not going to talk a lot. I'm going to just let you tell people about the book, what made you write the book, and share some of your experiences. And I'm going to say at the outset that it's no way humanly possible for us to extract the very important information that you have in your possession in the book, on printed page, and in your heart that you can share with the listening audience. So I want to say that this is probably going to end up being a series. And so you may be with us for a while, if that's okay with you. I'd like to invite you maybe about two or three times for the next two or three weeks.
That's
if
fine
you
with
can
me.
Find the time to come on with us, I'd love to have you.
As long as you don't get sick of me, that's fine.
and before I forget, I want you to be sure to tell people where they can get the book and all of that good stuff. How about that?
Well, that's fine. Now or later?
You can tell them later, but I just want to make sure that you do that.
Okay. I'll get that in there, yeah.
Okay. So why don't you start with, tell us what made you write the book?
Well, when I was a kid, and this would be about 1960, 61, my folks would take me on the train from time to time. This was in the San Francisco Bay Area, so this would be the Southern Pacific Railroad. And I noticed these fellows on the train, and they kind of, there was a difference about them aside from their color. They were very nice to me, and I just picked up this kind of a vibe. And, you know, some people have said when I was writing the book, those cars were just cold pieces of steel without the black men who worked them. And I would agree, because whatever I picked up, I guess, you know, in the 60s, we started to call that soul. Whatever soul is, I think it's true. They possessed it. It was, they had Filipinos work the trains for a while. They had white people at times, and it just wasn't the same. So whatever the black man gave to those trains, he gave them a soul. He gave them life. So even as a kid, I picked up on that. And then years later, when I started working for Amtrak as a porter, this would have been 1980, a lot of these old guys were just running out their final miles, and they'd sit around in the dining car, and they'd say, Amtrak ain't nothing. You know, the old days, you should have been there on the Super Chief or the Lark, and they just had this pride. You know, you could see it on their faces. You could hear it in their voices. And I was like a fly on the wall. I was just absorbing all this, and I thought, gee, somebody better get this down before all these guys die out. So I just set about to do it, and started with one person, and then he led me to another, and I just kind of jumped around, did a lot of interviewing, and 12 years later, the book got published.
That's very interesting. What the important piece is that you just shared is that for decades, the African Americans who worked on the railroad as on the onboard crew were all African American.
Right.
And then you come along, or your peer group came along to sort of pick up the slack, if you will, where because they were all older and retiring, and you were filling the void that was going to be left by this significant group of railroad employees. And I think that's interesting to note that how you even perceived it, that it was just something different about them. But I'm going to be quiet and let you continue.
Well, you know, when I came on there in 80, Amtrak broke the color barrier and the sex barrier. They had men and women, a lot of white people, all different kinds of people working on the trains. And, you know, you could tell. I mean, it just kind of deteriorated into this generic kind of thing. And, of course, the trains, all the old equipment was being retired. And you know, Amtrak today is a far, far cry from what it was back at that time. And, well, you got to figure, emancipation was 1863. Pullman built his Pioneer sleeping car, his first car in 1865, and he needed someone to staff that car, so the most logical choice would be the recently freed slaves. And then you think of it. So by the time that 1926 rolled around, which was peak year for the Pullman Company, it had only been about 63 years since emancipation. And why, it's been over 50 years since the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan, and I lived through that. So 1863 to 1926 was just a hop, skip, and a jump from the plantation, and that's basically what it was. They took the plantation system with the white overseer and the slaves, and they put it on the trains, and all the conductors were white. Lounge car man was white. All the Pullman employees and the offices were white, but all of the porters and the busboys and the dining car waiters, they were all black. And it was the same kind of a deal with how they treated them. You know, some of the conductors, and they were decent men, but a lot of them were, you know, still had that old kind of plantation mentality. And it's interesting that it was culturally significant because at one time only wealthy people could have black servants. And now anybody who bought a train ticket could be served by a black man, and you didn't have to be wealthy. It all trickled down, and this went out into societies, in the cities and towns, and that plantation hospitality appealed to the white clientele, and that's what installed this master-servant relationship in our culture. And it's stuck. You know, that's why it's taken so long to break this stereotype, because it was ingrained into our culture. And my theory is, you know, if you could transport a young black man today back to 1926, he couldn't go around acting like he does today. He'd be placed in an entirely different environment. He'd have a tough time finding a job. He'd find himself unable to speak to a white person as he would today. His very demeanor would make him suspect. The fastest way to make some money legally would be to go down to the closest Pullman Company yards and hire on as a porter or a busboy. And if they liked the looks of you, you'd be making money in a matter of days. But he would have a really tough time putting up with the many white passengers. But he'd have to learn quickly that to appeal to their vanity meant more and bigger tips. And Malcolm X, for those of you who don't know who Malcolm X is, he worked for a brief time on the Yankee Clipper train between Boston and New York as a dishwasher and a sandwich man selling food in the coaches. And in his book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, he stated, "We were in the world of Negroes who are both servants and psychologists, aware that white people are so obsessed with their own importance that they will pay liberally, even dearly, for the impression of being catered to and entertained." So that kind of tells the whole thing, but it was survival. You know, it was working the system. You had a family to feed. Anybody placed in that type of environment would have to work it the way the porters did. And James Steele said in the book, he was a porter, he said, "When I first started, you had to be careful. It was no joke. Well, listen, if the white man could kick your butt, he did. But if you showed him you could kick his butt back, he wouldn't bother you. I tell you how I dealt with it, by ignoring it. Long as you don't put your hands on me, I won't bother you." So that was kind of the conditions out there. And, you know, I've worked as a waiter in various restaurants in my life, and I smiled and gave good service and worked hard for those tips because it was in my best interest to do so. And millions of white kids and people have done that very same thing. So why should anybody put down a porter or call them Uncle Toms or Yassers or any of that, because they were just doing what they had to do to survive in that time? And, you know, it's true, in one way or another, we all have to serve somebody anyway. So I don't think that they should be put down for that. And I kind of think, in a way, they have been. I remember I was signing books somewhere in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and the young black man came up, and he looked at the book, and he kind of screwed up his face like it was Satan looking at him. And it kind of hit me at that time. He was looking at this, and he was kind of repelled by it, because I think that a lot of young black people today think that was an embarrassment, but they don't know the truth. They don't know that that was basically one of the first, or the beginning of the civil rights movement, and their fight against the Pullman Company, 12 years, you can imagine, like what I said, it was only 60 years removed from the plantation, and here they were trying to form a union, and they couldn't do it on their own. Philip Randolph came in there in 1925 with about 500 porters in New York City. Randolph gave a speech. In October, he started barnstorming every porter he could get in pool halls and everywhere he could go. And then they started to spread rumors that he was a communist and he wanted to make more money. And even churches, press leaders, union leaders, other union leaders, they were against him, saying, you know, stay away from him. He's bad news. We're going to lose our monopoly on this thing. And Pullman porters were beaten and threatened and intimidated in an effort to smash this union. Men were dismissed, secret union meetings and stool pigeons and all of that. Filipinos were hired for a while, and they told the porters, "We're going to hire Filipinos, and we're going to fire all you people if you keep on with this union." But anyway, for 12 years, Randolph and the porters fought. And then finally, in April of 1937, Pullman was forced to sit down at the bargaining table, and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union was became a reality. So that's an incredible thing. You look back in Black history, and I don't see how there's any way you can just remove that from Black history and find a way to jump from the plantation over to modern days without any realization of how it happened. You know, I can't see how, you know, in a Black history class, how you could eliminate all of this. I think that they mentioned the Porters in passing, you know, but it's such a big part of the history, both the country and Black history. I think it's been overlooked. You know, I really think it has.
Well, you know, what's important to me, it was important to me to have you on the show today because of all that you just stated, and it's why I wanted to have you on, because, as you know, I founded the A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum in 1995. And the reason that I founded the museum, because I stumbled literally upon that history. And I thought it was so important, so significant, that there ought to be a place that honored that history for the very reasons that you outlined in your statement. And so for 21 years, I have done just that. And there have been all manner of people who have come through over the years because of the significant body of research that I have done that is not recognized in the academic community because I'm not an academician, but I do hold a PhD. I made a choice to operate the museum to honor that segment of history because I do believe, as you just stated, it is important, not just to Black history, it's important to civil rights and it's important to labor history in general. And so now that the Pullman National Monument has been established, there's all manner of people who are suddenly experts on the subject. And it is commercialized, I won't say the other word, but it's commercialized in a way that I find distasteful. And I don't know anyone out there who knows more about this history than you. And on the research side and on the academic side, even though I'm not a professor at a university, I am an academic and I have a doctorate degree to state that. And the research that I have done, no one has. No one has. And there's been people who have come to the museum to ask if they could use the research that I have, and because I didn't acquiesce to the terms of how they wanted to use it, so they go off and spin off and do a book, and you know, with the sound bites. But no one out there has done a book in depth and addresses that component of history from the human side, the humanity of those men, who they were and what they represented, because they didn't always stay in the slave mentality. Many of them were educated, as you well know, but chose that profession because it paid very well. And as most people are beginning to learn, they were the foundation for the Black middle class, and we owe them big time. We owe them. And this subject is so expansive that we want to formally ask you if you will come back for our next show to continue this subject matter. I'd like to delve into it a bit more.
I'd be happy to.
So David Perotta's book is Those Pullman Blues, and you want to share with the listening audience how they can find the website or where they can find the book so that they can become enthusiastic about it as I am.
This is a new edition that I put out in 2014, and it's only available on my website right now. And that website is www.thosepullmanblues.com. And you can download it, or you can buy a hard copy. And I have a free chapter on there that you can download, so you can get some sort of an idea about what this book's all about, and a lot of photographs, and I hope you come and visit.
Well, David Perotta, thank you so very much. We're honored to have had you, and we look forward to your next visit. And for the listening audience, we will put the web address up on our show page so that you can find the book. So visit live from the Pullman National Monument on BBS Radio, and you'll find our show page, and there we will have all of the information that will assist you in finding David Parada's book. You gotta buy it. You gotta buy it. And so thank you, thank you, thank you, David. And we're going to take a short break and be back with our guest, Mr. David A. Peterson, Jr., who is president and executive director of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. Well, welcome back to Live at the Pullman National Monument, and this is segment three. Our guest for this segment, which is called Around the Museum Table, this segment will be happening each show, where we will be inviting professionals from the museum community representing different institutions, and they're going to come on and talk to us about the things that they're doing and what's happening at their specific place. I am honored to have today, as our first guest on this segment, Mr. David A. Peterson, Jr., who is the president and executive director of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, located in the Pullman National Monument. Mr. Peterson, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Dr. Hughes and company. I appreciate you guys. I appreciate the innovation to put this vehicle together to tell the story that you've been telling for so long. And it's an honor to be here on this inaugural issue, if you will, of this round table.
So tell us who you are, what you're doing, and maybe highlight something special that you're doing about the museum.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I'll keep it very short about who I am because that's not too important in regard to just doing the work. As you said, my name is David Peterson. I am the president and executive director of the National A. Philip Randolph, which is a 21-year-old cultural institution. So that's where all of the attention really is for me. That's where all of the focus is. And with that being said, it's impossible to walk through these walls on a day-to-day basis and not be inspired directly by the contributions and work of A. Philip Randolph and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Dining Car Waiters, and Maids. So because that's the case, what we've been focused on is taking this story outside of the walls. Our experience here at the museum is so much more than just coming in, paying a donation, and getting the tour. It's not just four walls. It's an experience that people leave here with, and we like to think we do a very wonderful job of doing that. So with that being said, it has been our intent to once again take that story outside of the wall. So with that being said, what we've done is we've created different tentacles to the A. Philip Randolph governing body, if you will. And that's simply because, you know, we're not a constituency organization or a community organization. We're simply a cultural institution. However, the work is important, and the work is important to be told outside of these walls.
I'm sorry. I'm anxious to have you tell the listening audience about your newest project, which is the Youth and Young Adult Program Division of the Museum. You're doing some exciting things, and I'd like for you to share with the listening audience some of that.
Very good, very good. So in 2009, the cast from Good Morning America came to Chicago, and we had an opportunity to host them here at the museum. They conducted a wonderful interview, which aired on Good Morning America. And while they were setting up the set, you know, I just had an epiphany as I saw how wonderfully they were able to utilize the space. I had an epiphany, you know, what if we did something like this ourselves? So at that very moment, that's when the idea birthed for some kind of TV show that would be kind of like an American Bandstand or Soul Train or 106 in Park, but more culturally based in the museum. So we struggled with, you know, ways to do this and what we would call it, and we eventually came up with Museum 44. And the 44 was in honor of the first African-American president because we felt that we wanted to control our narrative and control the lens in which people saw young black youth in our city. We know because of the different types of youth that we have coming through these walls, through these doors on a day-to-day basis, that there are a lot of kids out there that are doing positive things. I mean, there are a lot of young adults that are doing positive things, so we wanted to find a way to highlight them within the realms of pop culture. So we created this umbrella called Museum 44, once again, where hip-hop meets history. The history simply being the setting where we are, which is the museum, and hip-hop being the language in which we would tell this story. So what we did was we came up with a way to empower the youth. So we created a recording studio here where kids could come in and, you know, kind of get off their chest the things that they wanted to talk about. But hopefully we hope that, you know, the subliminal messages that we planted in them through them walking through the museum would influence the type of content and art that they would display. So fast forward, moving forward to today, we've made a very strategic partnership with After School Matters, which is a City of Chicago program that basically provides youth jobs for kids. And it gives them the opportunity to learn different skills that they can then take into the professional world with them, and they're paid to do that. So this was an excellent addition to our whole movement, and we're so thankful to After School Matters for that. And we just started this summer, so we just completed our first summer session. We're very proud of that. We were able to hire 16 youth from the inner city to learn about history, heritage, and culture, and video production, because essentially what Museum 44 is a TV show, which once again will give us the opportunity to tell our own narrative. So those kids were very happy. A lot of them are now interested in video production. A lot of them are now more knowledgeable about the subject matter here, as well as African culture, which is prior to slavery.
Well, that is excellent. That is excellent. And again, this is just the first show of Around the Museum Table, and so we're going to have you back again. Okay. I did want to say one last thing before we leave today, and that is I would love to see, since this is the centennial of the Great Migration, of the mass exodus of African Americans from the South to the North, and everywhere in the United States they're celebrating the Great Migration Centennial, I would love to see Museum 44 take on a project that would mirror or contain or create some sort of final project that the kids could do for this year and would help them not only understand the Great Migration Centennial themselves, but also what it means historically, because it is where hip-hop meets history. And so I really would like to see that, and I would encourage you to do that. And I know that there are lots of wonderful things and celebrations about the Great Migration Centennial happening in across the country, but particularly in Chicago. And so I know that there is a Great Migration Centennial webpage. And so for the listening audience, for those of you who are interested, find that webpage. I believe it's Great Migration Centennial .com, I believe it is. But if you put in the Great Migration Centennial, I know that you're going to come across it. And the young woman who's heading up that effort, is her name is Paula Robinson. She's doing a fantastic job and very creative in putting that together, and the whole group that she's working with. And we are just thrilled and honored to have this group of people advocating for cultural economic development. After all, that is what the basis of this show is about, cultural economic development. And Mr. Peterson, we are thrilled to have you today, and we hope that you'll come back again soon. And I want to say thanks to our underwriters and supporters, of course. This show is brought to you by the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, Hughes Peterson Publishing, and my Rhythmist. Mind Spa for Human Potential. I think I got it right. So once again, thank you for coming. Thank you for listening to Live at the Pullman National Monument. See you next time.
Live from Pullman National Monument was brought to you by Hughes Peterson Publishing in Chicago, Illinois, and MyRhythm Mind Spa in Homewood, Illinois. Hosted by Dr. Lynn Hughes and produced by Dr. McIntyre Evans.